You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 290. Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you here in Niagara Falls, Ontario, riddled with disease, barely alive, just trying to make it through the evening without basically keeling over dead. Joining me on this funeral march out of Philadelphia, Mr. John Gentile.
Listen, Adam White, everyone is always on a never-ending funeral march. That is the station that man has been placed in, either through some cruel god or through the brutalist practicality that is nature.
Well said, Thoreau. Also joining me on the show tonight out of Los Angeles, which is, I guess, like being in the grave already, Mr. Ricky Frankel.
In many ways, yes, Adam. Glad to be here. Glad to be back.
You haven't been on the show in a while.
It's been, I think the last time I was on was with Sam Barrett when you weren't able to make it.
Probably because I was also similarly ill and not doing too well. This past month has sucked. I don't know about you guys. I don't know if maybe it's different in America. I mean, you guys have your own problems, what with your Donald Trumps and all that.
We got problems.
But our problems up here in Canada is I'm just going to say that maybe the winter hasn't been that cold, and because it hasn't been that cold, all of your tropical superbugs are just running rampant through our fragile immune systems. I don't actually know if that's true, but that's what I'm going to blame it on.
I got a tropical superbug once. It was like the worst day of my life. It was like I was at the courthouse and I drank out of a water fountain, and I usually wouldn't drink out of the water fountain at the courthouse, but I did because I wasn't thinking. And so I went throughout my day, everything was fine. At about 5:30, just when I was about to go home, I felt a little scratch in my throat. By the time I got home, my throat was inflamed. I could barely speak. I laid down like, well, maybe I'll be better. By 6:30, I was like, I gotta go to the hospital. I was at 1%. Like, my entire like throat glands were blown up. It felt like there was razor blades in my throat. I could still breathe, but like, I couldn't speak. I couldn't even swallow. So for some reason, I decided to drive to Walgreens, and I didn't know how I got there. And this was when they still had Theraflu, and I bought like the old school Theraflu that I think you can use to make meth or morphine or something. Mm-hmm. And they don't. It's so powerful you can't even buy it anymore. You're supposed to take one shot twice a day. I took 4 shots in a row, and honestly, it brought me back up to like 40% in like 10 minutes. And so for a week, I was doing about 5 shots of Theraflu a day. You're only supposed to do 2. But man, that it literally probably saved my life. If it didn't save my life, it saved me probably a week-long stay in the hospital. And I have no idea what that brutal virus was, but you can only get something like that at the courthouse, let me tell you.
See, I feel that all cold medicine stopped working for me after the meth thing happened, because I used to be able to go get just like pill based like Tylenol cold, and it would fix whatever was wrong with me immediately, and I could just go about my life. And then they reformulated it because of meth, and I may as well right now just be like eating rocks. Like, it does shit for me. It does nothing. So
it's like Flintstone vitamins medicine these days.
Basically, it's like all the good ingredients we can't have anymore because meth.
Because of meth. Thanks a lot, meth. Yeah. Thanks.
So, anyways, do we have any mail?
Yeah, we do. This first letter comes from Justin. He's written in several times before. This is Justin. He says, as always, more Greg Orb on the podcast. He is the best. Nobody says AJJ. Thanks. And that's from Jason.
Actually, yeah, this Ricky, this is going to give you your chance to chime in on
AJJ.
What was the name I liked? Actress always. January Jones. That's my
always just jerking.
That was, for me. Do you want? I mean, that was a very weird turn of events for the band. I mean, it's up to them, obviously. I mean, I had always understood the term jihad as like a struggle, and that's why I thought, just like in general, that it's usually like an internal struggle or something like that. I don't know a lot of Islam, but to me, the fact that it meant something like an internal struggle or even an external struggle, to me, like, fit that band's like their sound and their just kind of like their aura very well. So I didn't know, I didn't realize it was like one of those just random names it came up with. But you know what, the band's gonna do whatever they want to do. This was that situation though was one of the first times in a while where people were just literally just commenting on the band's announcement on Facebook. They're calling them sellouts, and like being serious about it. So, but I don't think so. I mean, if they had changed their name right when they signed to Side One Dummy, I would have asked questions probably. But there's no. It seems like it was just a band decision. It was a very odd turn of events, I thought.
And this is from Donnie. Donnie said, a band can call themselves what they want. If a band thinks the name is offensive and wants to change their name, that's really up to them. I can see your point, but it really is up to the band. And I guess they mean our collective point as a whole. That's from Donnie.
I don't know. I really feel like it should be up to me.
and this is from Lauren. Lauren says, band names are always stupid. I don't care what they call themselves. I still love AJJ is what she put. And then we got another email that I will not read, but it's this fellow giving an alternate name for AJJ, which is pretty offensive. It's AXCX level of offensiveness, so I'm not going to read it. So you can just imagine what you think it stands for.
You know what? If they could, I'm in love with actress January Jones. I would love to go see actress January Jones if she comes to town. There's so many ways that you could use that to be awesome. Please do. Well, the three of us are on the show. We usually talk about records when the three of us are on the show. Let's briefly do that because there's a little bit of record news that we can seg that into. So, Ricky, John, whoever wants to go first here, what's your latest finds? What's going on? What are you listening to?
Hit it, Rick.
You know, I might repeat myself because I believe it or not, I do not have a very long list. So there might be a few I might have said the last time we did this, which was a while ago. First of all, I definitely know I forgot to mention way back in like November that I got Leftover Cracks Contracts Out of the State on the colored vinyl, that fat through the fat pre-order. It's like red with black splatter, and it just looks fucking awesome. They did such a great job with that physical release. Let's see here. Scrolling through the Instagram.
This is what everyone tunes in for, is Ricky narrates his Instagram.
Okay, so I also got the Shell Corporation's Mandrake on green with white splatter vinyl. That's a great band. I'm going to be seeing them on Friday. And then I got the Closet Fiend 7-inch from Fat. It's pink. That's all it is, just pink. And then one then this I know I didn't talk about because I think this I got this only like a couple weeks ago. I got the first pressing of the Gloss demo.
Oh wow, how much did you pay for that?
I paid 20, which is cheap.
Is that on CD or cassette?
No, 7-inch. Hmm. 7-inch, and then it came with like a little zine. I haven't read it yet, but I mean, come on, it's the Gloss demo. It's awesome.
So here's a question for you then. If it's on a record, then why is it a demo? You know what I mean? Like there's a KRS-One freestyle where he talks about no such thing as a demo exists. It all depends on what your intention is. So, I mean, if they're putting it out as an official release, is it a demo or a debut release, you know?
I don't know how to answer that, but I'm going to answer with someone needs to interview this band. We need to, I would, I mean, this is and I would ask that, like, for sure. But no, it's a very cool little release that I think. I mean, this band's clearly going places. So I thought this was a nice little find. And then this isn't something I bought recently, but I saw Toy Guitar open for the Loved Ones, like I said last time when I was on. And I got my Toy Guitar album signed by the band, which is very cool of them to do. And then I also found their self-titled EP on blue vinyl. Toy Guitar is just self-titled 7-inch. And then this was sort of an impulse buy. There's this record label out of New York. They're a purely online record label, and they are called Enjoy the Ride Records. And they reissue, like, just random albums for vinyl. And they did a SpongeBob soundtrack.
That's cool.
Just from, like, the first, like, season or two.
You know who's on that?
Ween and Pantera.
And you know who else is on that?
Are you going to say Blag?
Blag's on that.
Blag is that song is not on here.
Oh, it's not. Well, that's
Blag, it should be. I know Blag was like did a song in the first season. He did like Do the Sponge or something.
Yeah, there's a song on the SpongeBob soundtrack, the CD version called Do the Sponge, which was written by Salt Pedro of the Dwarves, who writes songs for movies and cartoons, and Blag Daddy does the vocals.
Yeah, it's not, for some reason it's not on that. I think they might do another one with more songs, because I mean there should be a bunch of awesome, stupid, fun SpongeBob songs on this. But it's like it came. They did a really good job with this one too. They it's like translucent yellow with orange splatter, and it's really cool. And I'm gonna end it on SpongeBob. So
SpongeBob is cool, man. I love the SpongeBob cartoon. Adam, like, do you watch the SpongeBob cartoon, or have you watched it?
I've definitely seen it, but it's one of those things that I like. I was both like too old for it, and then I missed like the people that were watching it ironically,
dude,
or maybe not ironically, but like, because I figure that like there's a whole group of people right now that watch like, I don't know, like Adventure Time, right?
Yeah, those assholes.
I'm just saying that like there's like, you know, adults out there that have latched onto this or that cartoon because it's really funny and clever, and they watch it, and I acknowledge that they do this. And I think to myself, maybe I want to be one of these people. But then I have no regular cartoon access. This is part of the problem. This is a Canada thing.
Don't you have two kids? That is
actually kind of sad sounding.
Don't you have two kids? That's primo cartoon access.
Yeah. I've seen Frozen 700 times. I have two kids. It's more so a thing where like a lot of the funny or the edgy stuff that like non-children would like that ends up being this animated stuff that like the internet has decided is cool and they like, I never have access to, because it never ends up on either, well, back when I had cable, it never really ended up on Canadian TV, whoever has the rights for it in this country has decided to not allow that kind of stuff on the Netflix. So if I want to go see something like whatever the cartoon is that everyone is talking about, I have to go to some really skeezy internet places to do these things. And I haven't done that in a long time because I don't have the time anymore. So like a good example is like when everyone was going crazy about the Venture Brothers, like there was no legit way for me to like watch that here. I have to like go into like the scammiest, you know, porniest place on the internet, and maybe someone has uploaded a copy with like, you know, like Turkish subtitles under it or something like that. You know, these are the problems that we have. Again, you guys have bigger problems. What with your with your scary election and all that. But
yeah, man,
these are our problems.
Anyway, Adventure Time is great.
You got SpongeBob though, right?
SpongeBob is almost as good as Looney Tunes. SpongeBob is great. But listen, we're not here to talk about SpongeBob. We're here to talk about records. Let me tell you about this new record that just came out. It's Queen, A Night at the Odeon. And it's a live Queen disc. And it's them live during the A Night at the Opera tour. So it's basically them doing a lot of tunes from A Night at the Opera. Bohemian Rhapsody. Let's see what else. Well, yeah, it's the only song from A Night at the Opera, actually, Bohemian Rhapsody. But they also do a whole bunch of like the earlier stuff, like Brighton Rock from Killer Queen, White Queen, Ogre Battle, Now I'm Here, Keep Yourself Alive, Liar, and they do this really neat medley of Jailhouse Rock, Stupid Cupid, and Bebop Alula, as well as Big Spender. And I've asked this question before. A, this is fantastic. It just really does go to show how amazing Queen was and how amazing they were live. I don't think I've heard any other band that is this, I guess, polished, but still organic and real sounding playing live. Queen really was an amazing band. Freddie Mercury was an amazing singer. And I don't know why all these record companies held on to these fantastic live recordings for so long. Like the Rolling Stones are doing a phenomenal series of reissues of stuff from the 70s through now, live discs. Queen put out, you know, Live at the Rainbow 2 years ago, and now Queen and Night at the Odeon. Why did Queen like keep putting out like shitty live albums from the 80s when they had this marvelous live record from the 70s during their prime? It baffles me as to why it took so long to put these out. But listen, in the current music economy, I'm glad the record stores are record companies are putting out these, I guess, more obscure live records. If you like Queen, the first live record you should get if you're going to get a live record is Queen and Night at the Odeon. It is an amazing live record. The other thing, a couple of things I got is this is cool too. Adam White and Ricky, do you guys know what The Wall is, or now it's called FYE? No. Well, maybe on the East Coast of the United States,
it is a super familiar acronym, but yeah.
There was this music store called The Wall. It was basically a competitor to Tower Records, though not quite as hip. Like Tower Records had a lot of rarer stuff or more obscure stuff. The Wall had some obscure stuff, but not a whole lot. About 15 years ago, they got put out by this company called FYE, which, I mean, as far as chain music stores go, they're okay. You know, they'll have The Clash, and they'll have, like, maybe a couple of Black Flag CDs. Not a whole lot, but as far as chain music stores go, they're all right, except for they're one of the main reasons why the CD market crashed. All the CDs there are $17, $18, $19, $20 for a single CD, which is outrageous. Well, about every 3 or 4 years, one of them closes up, and when they close up, they have these phenomenal sales, which is good for me, even though I'm kind of sad the music store's going out of business, although they're not an independent one, so it's not that big of a deal. But I feel bad for the people that lose their jobs. So anyway, the one near me is going out of business. Right now, all the music is 40 to 60% off, and I've just been scooping it all up. I've got Ministry, the 12-inch singles from 1981 to 1984. Now, a lot of you might know Ministry as kind of like this super heavy, super nasty industrial band. And Ministry probably was the first industrial band. And if you don't know much about Ministry, you should check them out, especially if you're a Nine Inch Nails fan. Everything Nine Inch Nails does comes from Ministry. Well, this 12-inch singles collection is very interesting because before Ministry was an industrial band, you know what kind of band they were, Adam or Ricky?
I don't think I know.
They were kind of a dark 80s new wave pop group. And if you have the very first Ministry album, it's called, not With Regrets, like in Memorandum or something. Oh, I can't even remember the name of it now. The first Ministry album is this really neat dark 80s pop record. However, they actually put out 2 albums worth of singles before that, and it's called Ministry of the 12-inch Singles. And what's doubly interesting is some of the tracks are straight up 80s dark pop, dark wave, I guess they call it now, which is great. But some of it is actually kind of like goth or proto-goth industrial. So the band went from being like goth industrial to being 80s pop to being super industrial. So it's just it's a fascinating collection of proto-industrial, proto-even 80s music, like proto-80s new wave. Because some of these songs are from 1981, which that's pretty early. And proto-goth, well, not proto-goth, but, you know, early goth. So if you're interested in any of those genres and a unique-sounding record, you should check out Ministry's 12-inch singles. Another thing I got at FYE while they're closing up was Meow the Jewels, which is a remix of Run the Jewels, except for it's with all cat sounds instead of vocals. And it was done for a charity, so I don't know how it wound up at the record store. I think there's a little bit of skeeziness going on there. But if you're a record collector, check out Run the Jewels, which is a great hip-hop group. And this weird-ass record called Meow the Jewels. It's a remix of the full album, which is with cat sounds. And what's neat is on the record cover itself, on Run the Jewels, there's like zombie hands. But on Meow the Jewels, there's like cat paws. And there's actual, well, not actual fur. There's actual faux fur. So the record cover is furry, which is interesting. Last thing I'm going to mention, I through certain sources, I recently picked up the original, well, not the only press of the Paint It Black demo. And really, I mean, I'm a pretty big Paint It Black fan. I think they're one of the best modern hardcore bands. I was surprised at how clean sounding the demo was. Paint It Black is when their production is extremely loud. It's, you know, that post 2004 production, which is extremely, extremely loud. So loud you almost can't hear it. It's just almost white noise. But the demo isn't quite as loud, I guess, because it's a demo. And man, what a fantastic band. What was that? Did you guys hear that?
I did.
Oh, it came from outside over here, I think.
Is there a domestic issue?
No. I don't know. No.
So anyway, well, the Paint It Black demo is pretty hard to find. You can hear it online, though, for free, or you can buy it, I think, for like $4 digital. And it just goes to show that Paint It Black really is a solid modern hardcore band that took the hardcore genre, avoided the cliches, but stayed true to the essence of this form of music. So it's a fantastic little record. Adam, what, you got anything cool lately?
I was going to go off this whole true to your roots thing, and it was going to end up about H2O. But so anyways, I do all my record shopping right now at shows, apparently. By design, but this is what happens.
That's the best way to support an artist. It really is.
Yeah, so the Sadies were in town the other day, and they played in the basement of a big old church in St. Catharines, and they did this with a big cardboard or a big plywood cutout devil behind them on stage that they brought with them, which was kind of fun. The Sadies, really great Toronto-based alt-country act. It includes Mr. Dallas Good, who plays in Career Suicide right now. Anyway, so I picked up two Sadies records there that I had not had on vinyl, but I do now. That would be New Seasons, which came out in 2007, and then 2013's Internal Sounds, and I think that was the last record that they had come out. And the one of the two of them, I think New Seasons is on this really cool pink vinyl, so that's nice. But I'm less excited about the records that I have bought and more excited about what's going on this weekend, because I'm probably gonna spend a stupid amount of money here. But we've got a record release show from the Dirty Nil in town on Saturday. And they're playing with Solids out of Montreal, who we played in the podcast last night. And they're playing with Casper Skulls out of Toronto, who we played in the podcast like 2 weeks ago. And all of these bands have records that I need physically. So there's going to be some awkward standing around at a show with an armful of vinyl thing happening.
Actually, Adam, what's your strategy with? I'll never forget. I got a Jello Biafra record once, and it got bent up with me holding it. I got it at that club in San Francisco. I can't remember the name of the club. It was like by a gas station, and it was for it was Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine, and I can't remember the other bands. But Adam, what's your strategy when you've got a handful of records? And at your upcoming record show, are you hoping to get tour only exclusives, or maybe even record release show exclusives?
You know what? There was a version of Higher Power that was like a pre-order that you could get that was like, I don't know, it was like turquoise blue, and it was a different cover and everything like that. But I have a self-imposed budget for this kind of stuff, and I was like, well, I'd either get this pre-order thing or not and actually respect the budget that I sent. So I didn't do that. So if they have those, then great. I'm going to grab one of those at the show, of course. But if not, I'm just happy to get the real thing because it's good. But, you know, you never know what kind of crazy stuff you're going to get shows. I find it's a little bit easier these days for me to be standing around with merch, only because, like, I'm now old, so I can stand there with a beer and something in my arms, and I'm pretty reasonably sure that I'm not going to get mashed by someone, so long as I'm not dumb enough to go stand in a place where I'm going to get smashed by someone. So, you know, it's probably okay. This is a show where I probably want to get up there, though, so I don't quite know. I'm just going to assume that because it's a record release show, they're going to have lots of shit, and it'll be there when they're done. And
don't risk it, Adam. Don't risk it. I'm telling you, don't risk it. Buy it first. Go to your car, lock it in your car, and come back.
That is the best. And whenever I can pull that off, I feel like a complete champion because I have unencumbered myself. But, you know, that you never know.
A venue's ins and outs policy are important in this case.
You could just be like, I'm Ricky from Punk News. Fuck you. I'm going to my car and just knock someone over.
Would not ever fucking do that because chances are I wouldn't be able to knock them down anyway.
I do that all the time, walking down the street. I'm like, I'm Ricky from Punk News, and I punch someone.
That's like one time I had an accident in the hotel, like in the hotel bed. You know, I ate too much, and so I went downstairs. And I said to the clerk, "I'm Ricky from Punk News. Don't worry about it." And then I left.
So gross.
That's not a real story, Ricky.
But yeah, it depends. I mean, that the ideal situation for that is just to buy it as soon as you can, and then just put in the car. But if you can't, what I usually do is I'll wait till like maybe if I really, really want something and there's something that's like a Tor exclusive that could possibly run out, I would definitely buy. I would get out of the pit maybe like at the end, maybe at the end of the set, and then during the time before the encore where there's nothing happening, I just go and get it then.
Not me. Like with the Melvins, like I get there early in line, number three, number four in line, so I can get to the table and get those rare jams, man. I don't care. I want them at all costs.
You see, the problem is that, like, sometimes the band is too small for you to pull that Ricky move that you just explained. Because, like, when I, like, the Beverleys were in town the other day and I wanted, like, a shirt or something that they had. And it's like, if they were on stage, there was no one selling their stuff. So then I just kind of had to, like, wander around until I found one of them and be like, can I buy something from you? And they're like, oh, yeah, cool. Someone wants to buy something from us. And then we go make that happen.
I'm so annoyed when bands, like, have stuff for sale, but they're never there. You know what I mean? It's like, I want to give you money. Let me give you money. And
not everyone can have a merch dude, I guess.
No, but I mean, like, why do you have your merch there if you're not there to sell it? I guess it's because they don't sell that much per night, and so they don't really pay that much attention to it. And I guess that's what it is, you know?
Well, we're going to briefly say, since we're talking about records, that this is... I'm going to comment on this before I even read it, is that this is really lame, but Metallica... are officially the ambassadors for Record Store Day 2016. What this means is that they'll be part of the rollout of Record Store Day info. I don't exactly know what that means. Like you're going to give like one of them like a scroll with all the records on it. And they're going to like stand in the town square and read it. Like, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but Metallica will be involved somehow with the release of Record Store Day info this year. They themselves are going to be releasing a live album called Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, Metallica, which was recorded at the Bataclan. The band will also be working with record stores to raise money for the Give for France charity, which is to help raise money for victims of the November Paris attacks that were at the Bataclan. So you can find a promotional video for this thing over on Punk News right now. Guys, any thoughts on Metallica being your official Record Store Day poster children?
Well, I'd just like to add to what your description of the video. It's an 8-minute video, okay?
Oh, you watched it? Oh.
It's about 2 minutes of it, and I'm like, this is way too self-indulgent. I'm stopping now. And I never understood the need for Record Store Day ambassadors at all. I mean, it's supposed to be a more democratized kind of a day. It's supposed to be, at least. But, I never gave a shit. When Jack White was the ambassador, I think... one of the Run DMC guys was it?
You mean Chuck D from Public Enemy, Ricky?
I apologize, Chuck D from Public Enemy. I never cared. I just want the few things on the list, and I don't know what this really does for it, unless it's just something for fun. But Metallica came off as super self-indulgent in this video, and
that has never happened before.
Yeah, exactly.
What a surprise. The band that released a double disc album where each song is 12 minutes long did something indulgent.
I mean, do you guys like these ambassadors? Like, I don't know anyone who actually cares about the Records or the ambassador.
It's a weird thing because I don't exactly know what they're supposed to do. It's one thing to have like a celebrity endorsement person if they're at least having, I guess, some sort of creative role in it. So like, for example, where you have like something like, say, like the Altamoros Parties Festival, where like they bring in a curator, right?
That's cool.
Where you ex- where you expect that, like, the guy who's the curator is helping make artistic choices about what's going on at the festival. So, like, okay, that makes sense. But this is pretty much, I mean, like, yeah, it's for Record Store Day, but, it could be for, like, Chiquita Bananas, right? And, like, Metallica are the official ambassadors of Chiquita Bananas now or something.
I mean, it just seems like this is sort of, like, publicity that doesn't really need to be there. It's more, I think the ambassador is really for Record Store Day, the program of Record Store Day, than the people that actually participate in it. Like, I do not care. I don't see how it's going to change anything at all.
I kind of disagree with you guys, actually. I think at the root of this, we need to address Record Store Day at first. I mean, itself, generally, and then that really affects my opinion of the ambassador's role. I think the point of Record Store, people have a lot of jaded opinions on Record Store Day. I think the point of Record Store Day is to bring attention to the physical record store, which is wonderful, and I think it's a noble purpose. However, and some people say, well, the point of Record Store Day is for the Record Store Day company to make money, which might be true too, because the Record Store Day company is a company. The unintended consequence is a lot of, it's hard to get records pressed these days because of Record Store Day. And I guess the criticism of Record Store Day is that records are too expensive and that record stores actually lose money doing it and that it's really not a worthwhile endeavor. Might be true. I don't know. If we assume for the fact that Record Store Day at its core is a good thing and can be made to be a good thing, then I'm all for the Record Store Day ambassador. The point of the Record Store Day ambassador is to bring notice to record stores. Metallica has millions and millions and millions of fans. Most of those probably do not collect records, and most of them probably don't go to physical record stores. Most of them probably buy the music on iTunes these days or stream it. So if Metallica can serve the purpose of getting people actually into physical record stores, then I'm all for it. I think it's a good thing. I think I don't know if Metallica necessarily has ever really had a connection to the albums or records themselves. I don't think Metallica is really that great of a band. I think they've got some okay records. I think Chuck D was a good choice because, 12-inch records are at the core of hip-hop, except for, most people actually don't even know who Chuck D is, to tell you the truth. But even my mom knows who Metallica is. Well, actually, maybe my mom doesn't know who Metallica is, but most moms know who Metallica is. And so if that's their function as the ambassador, I'm all for it. That being said, the core effect of Record Store Day, does it help or hurt record stores, needs to be addressed as the primary issue.
I think also, I mean, another criticism of it, and I see what people are talking about, but for me personally, I look at it a little differently. Records, a lot of people criticize Record Store Day for being incredibly something that really pushes consumerism and over-consuming.
But that's what record collecting is. Let's not fool ourselves,
I know, but, I remember seeing people just stacks, just huge stacks and bags of stuff that they got last year. And then me, I think I got a total when I went, I think I got 3 releases, and then I had to get one at a show. But I still got 4. And I just have my very my little list. I don't feel the need to buy we joke about this, but the next pressing of the first Clash album, I just don't feel the need for that. So, but overall, I'm a Record Store Day fan, and I'll probably I'll be at Amoeba this year for sure, probably for sure.
All right. Well, we just talked about Metallica and how they're raising money for the victims of the terrorist attack on the Bataclan. What I want to do is play a song that is also related to that. So Toronto band Grays, they've got a new record coming out on April 22nd on Car Park Records in the States, Buzz Records in Canada. This new record is called Outer Heaven. It follows up 2014's If Anything LP and last year's Repulsion EP. The lead single from this new record, the first song they've released from it, is called No Star, and it is directly about the Paris attacks, inspired by subject matter wise. It's about that. So fits really nicely in with that, with what Metallica is trying to raise some money for here. So this is Grays with No Star off of their upcoming record, Outer Heaven.
Don't shoot, I'm not. They want
right, we're back. Let's talk about some of the stories that happened this week. First of all, Brian Fallon of the Gaslight Anthem, the now on semi-permanent hiatus Gaslight Anthem, I guess. He's released a new music video for a song called Nobody Wins. It comes off his upcoming album Painkiller, which is set to be released on March 11th, 2016 on Island Records. You can find a link to the video. It's premiered over at Entertainment Weekly. You know, really, really, really in the mainstream here. John, did you check this out? I mean, I feel like we give these guys a lot of shit because they fall into certain stereotypes that you like to make fun of. But what did you think of this?
Actually, I had one thought, and then my thought was completely reversed halfway through. I'll tell you why. First of all, Painkiller. There's only one band that has an album called Painkiller, and that band is Judas Priest. All right? 1990, Brian Fallon, Judas Priest. They're a thrash metal anthem. And it is an amazing record. So Brian Fallon, just change the band name. You're not Judas Priest. You're not Rob Halford. You're not wearing leather with studs. You're not into S&M. You'll never be Rob Halford.
You don't know any of these things. These could all be true.
That's true. Maybe he isn't. Maybe. I thought you said you don't know that Rob Halford's into S&M. I'm like, yeah, dude, he talks about it like every interview. But you mean Brian Fallon. He very well might be. Anyways, so listen. Maybe I'm late on the boat on this, but I mean, Gaslight Anthem started out, you know, in the punk world, or mostly in the punk world, but this song is a straight mainstream song. I mean, is this the first purely mainstream thing Gaslight Anthem or Brian Fallon's done? I mean, this is, there's nothing, well, I'm not being judgmental, but I'm saying there's nothing punk rock about this. It's on a major label. It's a very commercial, pop, slick-sounding record. There's nothing really that daring or edgy or weird about the lyrics. So I think this is a mainstream record. And so we have the Gwen Stefani quagmire with Brian Fallon. Is Gwen Stefani is a pop a musician now? Do we still cover her? She used to be in No Doubt. No Doubt used to be a punk band, a ska band. Do you ever lose the connection to punk rock, or should we always cover you just because you used to be a punk rock person? This is not a punk rock record, and I think the song is rather bland. And honestly, he really does hit the cliches, like especially the Bruce Springsteen and the Tom Waits cliches, like tall grass, hallelujah, smoking cigarettes when you're 14. It's like, come on, dude. It's like so cliche, but the mainstream people eat that up. That being said, this video is messed up. I was like watching this video. I'm like, oh, so the guy had a girl and now he's no longer with the girl. And then you see about 2/3 of the way through, this video is messed up. I will give him credit. This video is shocking. It cut me deeply. Depending on people's different life circumstances, it might cut them deeply too. And so I don't know if this... I don't want to give the spoiler away, although maybe Adam, maybe we should. I don't know. I mean, should we talk about what actually happens in the video?
No, let people watch the video.
I will applaud him for shocking me. And even though I think this song is cliche and kind of stupid and kind of goofy and maybe kind of phony and kind of manufactured and affected, the twist of events that the video took made me take the song seriously. That's what I'll say.
I wanted to touch on... Oh, no. Go ahead, Ricky. Okay, well, I wanted to follow up actually exactly on the point that you made earlier, which, and this is why I wanted to talk about this story, which is at what point do we, or do we at all, leave an artist behind because they have, you know, they're out of the barn. They're not playing punk rock anymore. They're doing something else, you know, despite their connection. And I was thinking about this because, you know, Gwen Stefani is a good example. I was thinking even someone like, say, like more of a classic kind of person that we don't really talk that much about, at least maybe not to the amount that they deserve. But you look at something like, say, like Bob Mould's solo stuff, where, you know, we definitely talk about it from time to time, but no one is, I feel, no one's covering it to the degree that, like, someone from a band of that pedigree would be into. You know, I remember when we were, you know, back when Paul Westerberg was releasing all of his weird solo stuff on Anti, you know, no one was really talking about it all that much, and it was, you know, definitely not being covered to the degree that, like, a New Bouncing Souls record or anything like that would be. So at what point... Or, you know, do we just follow them because of where they started, or do we at some point walk away from them? And I was thinking about this as I was upstairs doing the dishes, and my kid was watching Frozen. And I think that I almost want to look at it from a sports perspective. And I don't think that, you know, we being punknews.org, we having that in the name, it's a little bit like being, say, I don't know if this exists, but it's kind of like being a magazine called, say, like Basketball Insider, right? Where we're not Sports Illustrated, we're Basketball Insider. We're very much talking about a certain thing in the name of the site. So let's say you have someone that's a big name in basketball and they go do something else. So, you know, so come back to say like all right, Michael Jordan Society is going to play baseball now. To a certain degree, Basketball Insider is going to cover that story because it's Michael Jordan. But then at a certain point, you're just talking about baseball, right? And then what are you doing? You're Basketball Insider. So you drop the story, and, you know, if he comes back and does something basketball related again, all right, you'll talk about it. But, you know, that is now a baseball story. Like, that's what it kind of feels like with some of these artists where, you know, we talk about them and then they start to go do other things. And I'm not judging them for going to do other things, like, you can do whatever you want. But at a certain point, you know, we are punk news. So, you know, I would be totally okay with, you know, if this is the direction that the next series of Brian Fallon things go in, I could be like, all right, well, you know, Godspeed, Entertainment Weekly will be happy to talk about this. Come back and see us when there's something punk rock to talk about. And I don't know. I feel that, like, I've gone back and forth on that over the years. But, like, listening to this, I was listening to this song and just thinking that, like, you know, despite how many punk rock people love his band, how much could we cover this before, you know, someone who is not familiar with that pedigree is going to step out and be like, what the fuck? Why is this on Punk News?
You know, I just bit on the song and then I'll respond to that. Yeah, the video is definitely dark. But I mean, I have ripped on Gaslight Anthem and Brian Fallon several times on the podcast. So I'll back off on that. I wasn't a fan of the song. It's not striking a chord with me really at all. In terms of what you're saying, Adam, I think, you know, I'm just looking at just the comments on the other Brian Fallon solo stuff, and it's not all that positive, or just no one seems to really want to, like, take it seriously. So, I mean, I don't think it's a terrible thing to keep posting about him. But I think, like, let's say he and the Gaslight Anthem were to get back together, I'd say let's just keep it going with them, because they're still they're relevant, and they were. I remember, you know, what, like, 5, 6, 7 years ago. I mean, they were one of the big punk news bands, and I remember Kira. I think it was Kira on the podcast a long time ago talking about how much she loved them, and I think other people on the staff did too. So I think at some point, though, yeah, I think at some point he as a solo artist, I think probably won't be need to be covered as much, just because, you know what, Entertainment Weekly and those kinds of more mainstream outlets seem to be embracing him. I mean, does he even need punk news as much now?
I guess not. I mean, I don't want to, like, make it sound like we're like casting anybody out to the cold or anything like that. Like, you're not playing punk rock anymore, blah, right? But I guess, like, there does come a point where we got to look and we go, okay, like, this is the fourth smooth jazz record that Chuck Reagan has put out now. We probably don't need to talk about this one.
It's another good example. Although he's not on Island. I think he puts his stuff out on his solo stuff on Side One Dummy.
Yeah, and I feel that, like, the label connections and stuff like that make it a little bit easier to hold on to someone like Chuck Reagan, even if he's just playing alt country music, because, you know, it's a little bit more of, like, the, you know, it's the same crowd that you're playing to. But to go release something like this on Island with a video with kind of, like, this amount of, like, you know, polish and prettiness and everything in it with a song like this, I mean, you're definitely trying to step away from the normal kind of like punk circles. At least it seems like that to me.
Adam, what did you think of the video itself? Did you think it was clever, or did you think it was kind of a manipulation?
I'm going to come out and say that I didn't watch that video. I turned on the video on my phone again while I was doing dishes and my kid was watching Frozen. But then I was doing dishes. So I've not seen the twist. So that's also why I did not want you to spoil it here, because I now want to go see what it is.
It's got a twist, man. It hit me. I mean, maybe some people see it coming, but I did not see it coming. Ricky, did you see the twist coming, Ricky?
Not really, no. I mean, it just... like I said, it just got pretty dark.
Well, hell, I'll just spoil the twist. It turns out that Brian found his RoboCop, so.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He is way too pretty to be RoboCop, let me tell you. Brian Fallon.
Well, listen, speaking of pretty boys, Tiger Army, they've released a new song. It's their first song in a long time. I think like maybe, I mean, not first song, but first, it's off their upcoming album. Their upcoming album will be out this spring via Lunatone and Rise Records. The new single is called Prisoner of the Night. I think like this is their first album in like 6 or 7 years, isn't it? Am I way off on this?
Not quite sure what they've released post Hellcat.
Yeah, I mean, for a while, Tiger Army were like not the Hellcat band, but one of the Hellcat bands, like the Hellcat crew. You know, they had that song "Power of Moonlight" and some other songs. And so, anyway, the new song, Adam, Ricky, what did you guys think of it? It certainly borrowed heavily from a certain 50s rock and roller. Yeah, first album in 9 years.
Yeah, 2007 was their last. So, yeah. And this new one, I'm assuming, is not on Hellcat at all.
No.
Rise Records.
Rise.
Oh, right. Okay, well, still.
The new Side One Dummy, right? Where
it's bigger than not, yeah. So, okay.
You know, I don't listen to them regularly, but was this not pretty tame for them?
This is about what they sound like.
They definitely mellowed as they went. Their last record was pretty, you know, it would definitely not like I feel like they really quickly moved away from being like psychobilly and kind of like the goofy 50s horror sense that those psychobilly bands, and they just kind of got into this like you know, like gothic romanticism thing. So this is definitely one of those kind of songs. What would you think?
Oh, I mean, I thought it was good. It didn't offend me at all. I mean, I don't mind these guys. I think they're rockabilly can be a good change after, you know, kind of listening to just other punk rock. It's just a nice way to mix things up.
John, is this something that you would ever be into?
Oh, you know, I'm not into rockabilly. It's like I like rockabilly, original rock. Like I like Eddie Cochran, and I like, you know, some of the Elvis rockabilly. But I was never into the whole, you know, modern people pretending that it's 1955 with the haircuts and the cars. And I don't like giving credence to the commenters usually. But this was one of the best zingers I've ever read. Someone wrote, was there actually people waiting for a new album from them? And then this person said, yes, but it was three girls with cherry tattoos on their necks that think it's the 1950s were a fictional place like Neverland, which it's a pretty brutal zinger, but it's kind of dead on. I thought the song – so anyways, if I want to listen to rockabilly, then I'll listen to actual rockabilly. I don't need to listen to manufactured rockabilly. And I think it gets kind of boring pretty quick, like just psychobilly in general. It's like a one-trick pony. That being said, this track is not strict rockabilly. It's not strict psychobilly. And I thought it was okay, but it's an issue I have with a lot of bands these days is they get it up to about 7 – but then they keep it there. They don't blow the house down by the end. Like listen to the Clash's Brand New Cadillac. That's Eddie Cochran, isn't it? Didn't Eddie Cochran do Brand New Cadillac? Please let me be right. Anyways, there's that famous quote by I think it's Cosmo Vinyl or Guy Stevens. All great rock and roll speeds up at the end, and the song self destructs. Look at New York Dolls' Personality Crisis, one of the greatest songs of all times. It blows up, you know, the song blows up at the end. This song just kind of gets up there and just kind of settles into the groove and doesn't really do anything after that. I think it would be a lot more compelling if it did that. Also, I couldn't figure out if I like the song or if I just like Del Shannon's "Runaway." To tell you the truth.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely in the, you know, it's pretty spot on with its influences.
Vince Taylor, brand new Cadillac is Vince Taylor, not Eddie Cochran. Vince Taylor, yeah.
So, like, I have a very similar reaction to this song in that, and really the same reaction to, like, any of kind of the latter day Tiger Army stuff is that I wish they would play a little bit harder, a little bit faster. And I think that they of any of the psychobilly bands from that era, they could do that and not be goofy about it. And I feel like they don't do it because they've tried to distance themselves from that kind of cartoony psychobilly. And I have a really weird relationship with this because, well, for two reasons. One is that there was definitely a time in my life when I was first exposed to psychobilly, which would probably be like 2001, when I actually stepped back and I thought, like, is this a thing that I could be into? Like, maybe this is my thing now. Because I just come from being a ska kid, and then that burned out. And it was like, is this a new thing that we're all going to do now? Because I'm kind of game. Like, I like the music that this is all cribbing from. So, you know, I could get a fucking pompadour and, you know, hang out with those people. I want to do this. But the problem for me with Psycho was just... there were very few Tiger Armies in it, and there was a lot of Necromantixes in it. And hey, not to cast too much shade on Necromantix, I remember because when I first heard Back from the Grave by whatever record that was came off of, they released in Germany back in like 2000, 2001, I thought it was the coolest song ever. But the problem is that, like, all their stuff was of a similar, like, cranked to 11 goofiness. And that gets, I don't know, that doesn't have a lot of staying power when everything just becomes like a big cartoon. But I had a lot of affection for Tiger Army back in the day. And I wish they would have kept, you know, kept things a little bit hoppier than they became. But can I talk for a moment about Hellcat Records in 2001? Because Hellcat in 2001 was my shit. Like, I'm just looking at the 2001 discography of Hellcat here, and I'm just going to skip over the ones that I think are junk, and it's still super long. So you've got, like, Leftover Cracks, Mediocre Generica comes out that year. Back at the Laundromat by the U.S. Bombs, which is really good. If you've never gone into the U.S. Bombs thing, I really like Back at the Laundromat. I think it sounds like a Sex Pistols record. You know, skip over Lars Fredriksson there. So Tiger Army's Power of Moonlight comes out. Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros, Global Agogo. The Nerve Agents Butterfly Collection comes out. The Slackers' Wasted Days. Sing Loud, Sing Proud by the Dropkick Murphys. F-Minus's Suburban Blight. There was so much good shit that came out on Hellcat in 2001. And I'm skipping over a bunch of stuff here that, you know, different people may like for different reasons. If you're more on the ska into things like... Although it was kind of a weird record for a ska record, but like King Django's Reason came out that year, which, yeah, you know, maybe that's a really weird record. But in any case, there was so much cool shit. 2001, Hellcat Records. And at that point, like Power of Moonlight, the Tiger Army record, I was just in love with. And nothing after that has, you know, nothing after that seemed to maintain that. So,
dude, Give 'Em the Boot 1, 2, and 3 are masterpieces, especially number 2. Like, even the songs that aren't that good on those comps or the bands that aren't that good, they're made good by their placement with other bands, you know? So, like, that one song contrasted to the other bands is awesome. Like Necromantix, like, I don't think they're that good of a band, but I think they're on Give 'Em the Boot 3, aren't they? Yeah, yeah.
They're on 3,
like,
Like,
it works so well after Atheist Anthem and before Power of Moonlight. Like those comps are just... great, man.
Yeah, so I mean, so hey, I mean, I'm gonna give this new record a spin because I really would like to be into Tiger Army. That seems like a thing that I'm down for, but I don't know if it's gonna happen. So yeah, you know, Tiger Army, there we go. This is a really long show. We want to play another song? Play another song, Ricky.
Yes. So I think not the last time, but the time before I was on, I had been talking about this older band called Apple, incredibly underrated. I wrote about them. I think the first time I wrote something for the very cool feature that we're doing, called What Are You Listening To? And they're just a band that should not be overlooked. They're like 80s pre-crust punk, you know, time where like everything was against Reagan, and the EP I'm playing a song basically is one of those great collages of anti-Reagan, art, album art. So I'm going to play a song by Apple called They Never Said It Would Be Like This off their 7-inch called A Sensitive Fascist Is Very Rare. So here's Apple with They Never Said It Would Be Like This.
Was Apple. We're going to talk about a few more quick things before we wrap it up here. John, this is about your old stomping ground here. You take this one.
Well, February 19th was declared Green Day Day in Oakland. There was a big show, a benefit for 924 Gilman, at, I think it was the Fox Theater, which is a very large theater in Oakland, and they raised money for Green. They may raise money to keep 924 Gilman in business. And what happens, a whole bunch of bands got together and played a bunch of Green Day songs. The irony being, of course, that Green Day was famously denied to play 924 Gilman, except for when they need money. April 19 was declared Green Day Day by Mayor Libby Schaaf, basically in part for Gilman's the organization working towards saving 924 Gilman. 924 Gilman is a great venue. I disagree with a lot of their policies, but overall I think it's a great venue, great place for the youth to go hang out. We diss a lot on Billy Joe, but you know what? I mean, he kind of does represent Oakland or the Bay Area in that, like, you know, a lot of people would get famous and rich and say, you know what, I don't need Gilman Street anymore. What do I care? It's not my problem. But he's raised money for Gilman Street many, many times. And actually, was it 1234 Go Records? He built their stage and bought them a sound system. And so he really is – I think he does his fair share in basically keeping the underground community alive, even though he's a literal pop rock star. But, good on him. I guess it's nice that Green Day has a day dedicated to them, and I can't hate on him for that. I really can't.
No, I mean, this was something that honestly was probably bound. If you had told me this, like, a year ago that this was going to happen, I would have been like, probably is that definitely they're the biggest band to come out of the area. So I figured this didn't surprise me. How about that? I think what's interesting is the bands all decided to cover the band's major label debut, when that's what got them kicked out of Gilman to begin with. So, isn't that what I think that song by them called 86, which I think is on either Insomniac or Nimrod. I think that's what it's about. Do they deserve it? Yes. I'm not also going to hate on them for that. There are some little hypocrisies that are there, but...
Well, not on Green Day's part, on Gilman's part.
No. On Gilman's part, but I'm not going to rip on them for that either. I agree, it's a great venue. If you haven't been to Gilman, when you first walk in for the very first time, you just kind of feel like, yeah, I'm home.
Oh, really? I felt the exact opposite. When I walked in, everyone treated me like an asshole because I wasn't dressed like everyone else. Like I felt like, man, I'm in a strange land.
It was a long time ago. I was probably just wearing a band t-shirt and like jeans, and I was fine.
You must be cool.
I got a little bit of attitude from like the staff there when I needed a membership, but like that was a child that must have been like 13 or 14 years old, so I really didn't care.
Yeah, I get nonstop.
You didn't just say I'm Ricky Franco from Punk News and like push him over.
Oh, and we bring it full circle. No, I didn't.
Good night, everybody.
Although at the time I was a little tempted to. No, but the
Ricky, did we ever go see a show at 924 coming together?
We were about to, and I don't think we did.
Maybe it was Ceremony. It was Ceremony, I think. Yeah, we saw Gnar Boots at the DNA Lounge.
Yes, in San Francisco. But yeah, if you can go to Gilman, go. It's worth it.
Yeah, Gilman's cool. I mean, I think a lot of the policies are dumb, but it's good. You know,
someone was telling me when I went to that one show that I saw there, they were telling me that there are all these proportions as to, like, in terms of major label distribution for a band, and like, and how that coincides with how if they allow the band to perform there, and it got stupidly confusing for something that should be simple and just lighthearted and fun.
Listen, Ricky, if punk rock is not about rules, what is punk rock about?
No, I mean, listen, I had to make sure I counted. I have to make sure I count every stud that is on my disgusting, unwashed jean vest. So, no, I do follow the rules of punk rock.
You got to feel bad for the guy that cleans the bathroom at Gilman. That bathroom is bad. I feel so bad for that guy.
Yeah, it's not good there. It's a scary sight.
All right. Well, a couple of quick media links that we're going to talk about before we wrap it up. The first is that there is a new full length from Face to Face that's out. It is called Protection. It is streaming over at the website The Big Takeover. The album comes out on March 4th, 2016 via Fat Wreck. So go over there or go to Punk News and find the link to go over there. And you can stream the new Face-to-Face record, Protection. John, take this last one here.
Well, at Punk News, we are streaming the new split with Heartless Folk and Rats in the Wall, which is Brad Logan and Ava Hall, Brad Logan of Electric Crack and Ava Hall of Gather. It's their new-ish hardcore band. They've been around for like 3 or 4 years now, so that's not that new. Real quickly, Ricky, did you check the split out, and did you dig it?
Yes, I had heard about the split when I saw Heartless Folk and Rats in the Wall in LA late last year, and Brad Logan told me about it, and so I've been looking forward to it. I gave it a listen when it first started streaming, and then I did later today. Overall, it's pretty good. Heartless Folk are actually, they're a Gilman band that people should check out. I think I played a song of theirs a few episodes ago, but overall it's pretty good. I'm gonna still sit with it and see how I like it overall, but so far
I'm loving the Rats in the Wall half. Brad Logan is the master of punk, crust punk, hardcore punk riffs. He is a master, and he is a man. I love the sound of his voice, and plus Ava Hall, she brings such fire. She's very direct. She's not shy. She's very clear about what she's saying. And she's got a real good scream to her. So I dig this split a lot. Let's play a track off of it. This is The Unknown by Rats in the Wall. You can get the split, which is Heartless Folk and Rats in the Wall, off Black Noise Records, which is Brad Logan's label. So once again, this is The Unknown by Rats in the Wall.
Okay, that was Rats in the Wall. We are done for tonight. If anyone wants to send us an email, you can do so at podcast@punknews.org. And I think that's it. Is that it? We done?
Yeah.
I can put my shirt back on?
You know what I tell the people? Like, you know, sometimes I'll be out, I don't know, at a ball game or, you know, even at, like, Denny's, and I got my shirt off, and they say, sir, you have to put your shirt off. You have to put your shirt on to be at this establishment. I just say, fuck you, I'm Ricky Frankel, Punk News.
That's going to become a thing, and I hate it so much.